After the movie Free Willy became a hit, word got out that the star of the film, a killer whale named Keiko, was sick and still living in a tiny pool in a Mexican amusement park. Fans were outraged. Kids demanded his release. I'm Daniel Alarcón. From Serial Productions and the New York Times comes The Good Whale, a story about the wildly ambitious science experiment to return Keiko to the ocean. Listen to new episodes on Thursdays. Want early access to the whole show? Subscribe to The Times at nytimes.com/podcasts to listen on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. Today, The Times reports that the House Republican in charge of investigating President Trump's ties to Russia was given secret reports by two officials from the Trump White House. And they call numbers at random, waiting to hear a woman's voice. Why young men in India are intentionally dialing wrong numbers. It's Friday, March 31st. It's the latest twist in a bizarre Washington drama that began on the night of March 21st, 10 days ago. Representative Devin Nunes, a Republican from California, was riding across town in an Uber when he got a call and diverted to the White House.
And his explanation for meeting his source at the White House was that he needed to use one of the secure facilities where you can legally view classified information. Mm-hmm. They're called SCIFs.
My colleague Matt Rosenberg is tracking this story.
It's not a watertight story because there are SCIFs at the Capitol. There are SCIFs all over Washington. So why was he meeting this guy at the White House? And it's not exactly like a congressman can just show up at the White House late at night and say, right, hey, I'm Rep. Nunes. This is like Jim from the NSA, and we just got to use one of your SCIFs. I mean, that's what his story would have you believe, and that's kind of fantastical.
This is how Nunes would soon describe what he learned that night.
I recently confirmed that on numerous occasions, the intelligence community incidentally collected information about U.S. citizens involved in the Trump transition. Details about U.S. persons associated with the incoming administration, details with little or no apparent foreign intelligence value, were widely disseminated in intelligence community reporting.
I saw intelligence reports that the Trump people were swept up into American surveillance, and it's really bizarre. He's confusing. He's kind of contradicting himself a little bit. He's saying, you know, this actually doesn't back up Trump's wiretapping claims, but that it sort of does.
President Trump seized on the information, saying it validated his recent claims that he'd been wiretapped by President Obama, a claim that had been received like this.
With respect to the president's tweets about alleged wiretapping directed at him by the prior administration.
From Democrats, Republicans, and members of the intelligence community.
I have no information that supports those tweets, and we have looked carefully inside the FBI.
There was great interest in where Nunes had gotten this information, because to make matters more complicated, Nunes leads a House committee charged with investigating President Trump on another matter, his campaign ties to Russia. Now, Matt Rosenberg is reporting the identity of the sources who provided that information to Nunes. They are two members of the Trump administration.
Now we know on the night of the 21st, he got a call, ran over to the White House, and an official there named Mike Ellis, he's a lawyer who's in the counsel's office, allowed Mr. Nunes to review the intelligence. But it wasn't Ellis who found the information. What we're told by a lot of different sources is that the information was found by a guy named Ezra Cohen Watkin. He is a former Defense Intelligence Agency official who was brought into the NSC as the senior director for intelligence by Michael Flynn, the former national security advisor who was fired in February. Mm-hmm. A few weeks ago, national security advisor H.R. McMaster tried to fire Mr. Cohen Watkin, saying he was in over his head. And his job was then saved by Steve Bannon and Jared Kushner. They saved his job.
So to be clear, Matt, what you're saying is that these were two officials in the Trump White House who shared this intelligence with Nunes. What does that tell us about how close Nunes is to the president and this White House?
Well, there's another detail here, too, is that we've got one official telling us, who has firsthand knowledge of this, telling us that Mr. Cohen Watkins began his search for this intelligence after Trump made his tweets about being wiretapped by the Obama administration. And this was part of an effort to find a post facto justification for those tweets. And so I think this tells us a lot here. You know, Mr. Nunes has at various times in the last few months been used by the White House as a surrogate to call reporters and kind of push back on various stories about the Russia stuff.
I mean, it looks even worse, though. It's not just about who Nunes got the information from that night. It's what he did with it the next day.
Nunes makes this briefing at the Capitol, kind of hastily arranged news conference. Then he runs off to the White House to brief Trump, saying the president had to know, even though the president is the subject of the House Russia investigation that Nunes is supposed to be leading. And then on the White House driveway outside, gives some more comments.
Let us get all the reports.
It is
possible.
And he does this all before he briefs anyone on the Intelligence Committee. That committee is normally very collegial, and what's standard is you share information with the committee before you run to the White House with it.
At this point, Matt, can Congressman Nunes lead an impartial investigation into the ties between the Trump campaign and Russia, which is his job? He is the chairman of this very sensitive intelligence committee.
It certainly doesn't look that way. The Democrats absolutely say, no, he cannot, and they've called for him to recuse himself.
You cannot have the person in charge of an impartial investigation be partial to one side. It's an inherent contradiction.
Some Republicans have joined in that call. So far, he's kind of dismissed it, and Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, has resisted those calls. But, you know, there seems to be no confidence on the Democratic side. Some Republicans are peeling away as well.
All right, Matthew, thank you very much. I know it's a busy day.
Sorry I'm rushing out so much, man. I hope that was helpful.
It was. Thank you.
Great.
Okay.
All right. Bye.
Bye. We'll be right back.
I'm Jonathan Swan. I'm a White House reporter for the New York Times. I have a pretty unsentimental view of what we do. Our job as reporters is to dig out information that powerful people don't want published, to take you into rooms that you would not otherwise have access to understand how some of the big decisions shaping our country are being made. And then, painstakingly, to go back and check with sources, check with public documents, make sure the information is correct. This is not something you can outsource to AI. There's no robot that can go and talk to someone who was in the Situation Room and find out what was really said. In order to get actually original information that's not public, that requires human sources, we actually need journalists to do that. So as you may have gathered from this long riff, I'm asking you to consider subscribing to the New York Times. Independent journalism is important, and without you, we simply can't do it.
Hello. Ellen Berry brought us a story from India about technology, romance, and a growing trend called phone Romeos. So, take us inside this call center in Lucknow, India. Describe the scene.
So in this call center, which is actually a police call center, there are banks of about 24, mostly women, taking calls that basically never stop coming. All day. And the calls are of a uniform nature, which is they are calls from women.
Mm-hmm.
Who have been getting harassing phone calls, often persistent repeating phone calls, from men.
Hello?
Neha?
Yeah?
I love you.
What?
Who are looking for sex, looking for love, or looking for romance.
Company ka naam I love you hai. Hum yahin se baat kar rahe hain. Abhi setup hua hamara India mein.
Okay.
Every country has crank calls, but I think what is interesting about what is going on in India is that there are increasingly guys who just dial numbers one after the other looking for a woman to talk to. And I think in some cases, when they hear a female voice,
hello?
They just try calling again and again.
Dial kiya hua number. The number you have dialed is currently busy. Please try again later.
So this is a kind of a phone stalking.
Hmm.
And it is remarkably common if you talk to young women.
Oh my God, I think I get like 3 calls every day.
Wow. Geetika Chakravarti is a 25-year-old in Lucknow, India.
They just call aimlessly like, hi, who is this?
Hmm.
Or hi, I want to get to know you. Now I've become sort of numb to it. Now I just block the numbers as soon as they say hello. I just know automatically I shouldn't be answering this call. But the first couple of times I was a little upset because there was this one man, he was very persistent, And he kept calling me and saying, hey, Geetika, I want to get to know you. How are you? Like, making conversation with me as if he actually knew me. And I was just like, can you please stop calling me? Otherwise, I'm probably going to have to report you to police. That didn't deter him. So he called from other numbers.
How many calls to these police call centers are being made every day complaining about these?
So right now when I visited, it was about 700 a day.
Wow.
Yeah. And so what the police commander in charge of the operation says is that it's basically increasing exponentially in line with the penetration of cell phones. Mm. And there is pretty rapid growth in India. It's moving a lot faster than China, for example. So call minutes are practically free in India, and you can now get a used cell phone for, I don't know, $14. SIM cards cost 100 rupees, which is less than $2.
Hmm.
So this technology of the cell phone is really kind of rewiring some of the social structures in India. India is a country in which many people, especially those not living in the cities, still live with pretty strict gender segregation. Mm-hmm. So that in many cases, particularly, I guess, in the north of the country, you have young men who reach adulthood without having a conversation with a woman outside their immediate family.
Do you know, Alan, how this became a phenomenon in Indian society?
I mean, there's always been a lot of what they call here Eve teasing.
Eve teasing. It sounds innocent enough, even a little quirky. But the term refers to a common form of harassment of women, often sexual in nature.
And the way Eve teasing sort of traditionally would work is...
Please stop being so cheap, okay?
I'm not being a cheap,
eh? Yes, you are being cheap. We will talk about it.
Guys hanging out at the marketplace and... spotting the girl and following her around. And just tracing her wherever she goes and talking to her and getting kind of insistent about her responding.
And dude, that's not buzz off. That's f*** off. You get that?
You deserve it.
And actually, if you watch Bollywood films, this is a theme that is just repeated over and over.
I love you.
Dar gaye kya?
That somehow romances often begin with a man spotting a girl who's unwilling to engage and persisting. Persisting for long enough that she relents. And this is the kind of the mating dance of Bollywood in a way. So it kind of lodges into the sort of cultural understanding that girls say no 3 times or 5 times and then very happily relent, which I think just sort of sets the table for all kinds of really awful harassment.
Yeah, I feel like, I don't know how many people are going to take offense to this, but I feel like Indian men don't, or men, I don't know, they don't deal with rejection very well, which is why... they're very persistent. No, the word no, I guess, does not mean a lot to these kind of people who actually get a kick out of calling girls like me or other women.
India is a country that is really very obsessed with romance, as you can certainly tell from its films. You know, the newspapers are full of crimes of passion, and obviously passion is kind of instructed to children as a positive attribute. It's in the literature, it's in the Hindu epics, it's carved onto the sides of temples. So there's really such a paradox that this is a country where unmarried young men and women are not supposed to know each other. But then love is really at the center of the culture in so many ways. So officially, there are no boyfriends and girlfriends in a conservative society of that kind. And unofficially, there's a lot of workarounds. And to my surprise, I discovered that that there was an anthropologist who has written a scholarly paper on this phenomenon in Bangladesh. And she had a very interesting view of it because she, among the garment workers that she was working with, she said some of them had 5 or 6 telephonic relationships with men that they would kind of juggle and carry on simultaneously. And that for young women who have been basically forbidden any association with men, that there was something rather advantageous about this particular kind of relationship because there was physical distance sort of presumed, which gave them much more protection and ability to set limits. But also, she said, because it, this kind of relationship, which is only over the phone, requires these young men to listen to them for long periods of time, which was something that these young women had never experienced, having a man who listened to them talk.
Ellen, that research you cited was conducted in Bangladesh. So I wonder if you're starting to see evidence that despite all of the anxieties and menace that these phone calls from random men represent, that some percentage of the women who receive the calls find them welcoming.
Yeah, it's pretty clear. And it's happening in lots of different countries. And since this story ran, I've heard from quite a few people from different parts of the world telling me that, you know, oh, well, this happens all over the Middle East. It happens. One person from Iran wrote to me to say, I know three couples who got together this way. Apparently in Kenya, it's so common that the number one downloaded app is an app to block phone Romeos. So when you create access in a very restrictive society, all kinds of things happen, good things and bad things. I just think the phone has made it much easier. It's sort of creating a pipe, and anything can go through that pipe. Good things can go and bad things can go. The pipe itself is neutral. The pipe doesn't care what goes through it.
What happened when you reported this to the authorities?
They were just like, don't worry, like the next time you call, just let it go to voicemail. Just don't pick up. It apparently had called over 500 girls, if I'm not mistaken.
Wow, one person.
Something like that, yeah. And he used to spend like 2 or 3 hours a day just calling in the hope of, you know, landing a conversation with someone. I don't think it was with malicious intent. It was just to see if someone was out there for him. But yeah, I definitely wouldn't advise someone to do that if they're looking for love.
So it sounds like despite this kind of harassment, you seem to understand why someone might do this, as kind of awful as it might feel.
I do, but I don't agree with it at all. I mean, yes, okay, you might not be very exposed to talking to girls. And apparently this man, he was a very quiet guy and he's probably never spoken to a woman in his life, something like that. So maybe hiding behind a phone gave him more confidence. I don't really know.
I want to get an idea of the repercussions here. What's at stake if a woman gets caught having these interactions with a man on her phone?
Well, there are lots of conservative communities, especially in the north of India, where young women aren't allowed to have phones at all. And this is the reason, because they're afraid that as soon as the daughter gets a phone, she has a boyfriend. I mean, these things are just really associated very directly with one another. And if you look at the statistics in India, women have far less access to mobile phones than men.
Ellen, what are the repercussions of having a boyfriend, not just a phone?
Well, it depends what kind of community you come from. I mean, you certainly hear, I mean, the catastrophic stories about honor killings and young couples who end up getting murdered by their, you know, cousins and brothers because it's an intercaste relationship. I mean, those are out there. But I think more often is probably the kind of thing that I heard about with the girls that I was following, which is they are kept under much more confining circumstances if they're found out. And I suppose it has some impact on their marriageability because the girl is always sort of prepared from birth for a marriage market. I mean, these are communities that are almost all arranged marriages, which are bargains between families. And if the girl is seen to have any kind of romantic or sexual experience, then her value is less.
Where do you think this all comes from? What you're describing as the way that some men in India are treating women and you in this phone call?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like growing up in a typical Indian society, men and women are not looked at as equals. And it's as simple as that.
So finally, back to the police call center. I'm interested in the role of the police in all this, who are taking these calls of concern. Are they helping to protect these women, or are they helping to enforce these societal strictures in India?
those two things happen at the same time in India in so many different scenarios. In this case, these are women who are complaining about harassment and who, I think, haven't had a very good means of defending themselves or protecting themselves. So I think it's an unambiguous good there. What is more ambiguous to me is that what they're sending out now is anti-Romeo squads that basically find couples that are together and interrogate them, I suppose on the assumption that the man is somehow forcing himself on the woman. That I would put more on the side of constricting the women's freedom to have a love life.
Ellen, thank you very much. This is a really fascinating story.
Well, thank you.
Here's what else you need to know today. North Carolina has repealed a controversial law that restricted the rights of transgender people. The 2016 law had required people to use restrooms that matched the sex of their birth certificates rather than their gender identity. And it provoked boycotts of North Carolina from companies, entertainers, and sports leagues.
Today, we repealed House Bill 2, and we began to end discrimination in North Carolina.
And President Trump is threatening political payback against House conservatives who derailed the Republican health care plan, promising in a tweet to campaign against them when they seek re-election next year.
What I am encouraging our members to do is keep talking with each other until we can get the consensus to pass this bill, because this is something we all said we would do. And so he is just expressing his frustration. You all know that he does that in various forms, including Twitter. And I understand his frustration.
Finally, I want to thank all of you who responded to yesterday's show. It was by far the most feedback we've received for an episode. We started by talking about the science of climate change and ended by talking to a coal miner about his story. Some of you wrote to say how much you appreciated hearing that perspective. Others felt we had not challenged that perspective with more of the science. We'll keep listening to people here at The Daily, including you. You can email us at thedaily@nytimes.com or leave us a review on iTunes to let us know your thoughts. The Daily is produced by Theo Balcom, Andy Mills, and Lisa Tobin. Our theme music is by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. Special thanks to Samantha Hennig, Pedro Osado, Andrew Phelps, Michaela Bouchard, Peter Sale, and Campbell Robertson. That's it for The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. See you on Monday.